Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. My name is Carl Shinneman, Director of Analytics and Review with Juranov. And here at ESI Bytes, we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available whenever they're interested in listening to it, which is when you download it or put it on an iPod or something else like that. Today we have a real great show, as we have Judge James Rosenbaum, a U.S. District Judge from Minnesota, and Jonathan Redgrave, a partner in Washington, D.C. with the AmLaw 100 law firm Nixon Peabody, joining us to talk about proportionality in e-discovery. Before we start the podcast, I just wanted to add that after finishing a recent show with Judge Grimm and Tom Allman, they both said they thought the next podcast should be on proportionality. I know there's a lot of interest and focus on this term among e-discovery practitioners, and given the fragile national economy, it seems to be getting much more attention by both defendants and also the judiciary. So I'm really looking forward to doing the show to see what two e-discovery experts who I have a lot of respect for say on this topic. Introducing the panelists briefly here, Judge James Rosenbaum is a federal judge for the United States District Court for the District of Minnesota. He began practicing in Chicago, Illinois as a Vista lawyer, trying federal civil rights cases, and then in 1972 returned to Minnesota to begin private practice, specializing in trial work. In 1981, he was appointed Minnesota's United States Attorney, serving until 1985 when he was appointed to the United States District Court. He served from 1997 to 2005 as the Eighth Circuit's elected representative to the Judicial Conference of the United States, the judiciary's governing authority. He's a frequent speaker and teacher. His articles in defense of the delete key and in defense of the hard drive have been translated into nearly 20 languages. The articles are recognized for their analysis of the intersection of law, privacy, and technology. A few other noteworthy articles are in defense of the Sugar Bowl, which considers criminal investigations of electronically stored information, and in defense of Rule 808, Federal Rules of Evidence. Focuses on email and an unwritten rule. The judge has also lectured both at home and abroad in legal technology and intellectual property issues. Jonathan Redgrave focuses his practice on informational law matters and leads Nixon Peabody's initiative in this area. He regularly addresses issues involved in the discovery of electronically stored information, as well as issues concerning records retention and privacy policies and practices for clients. He's also a member of the Financial Services and Securities Litigation Practice Group and has extensive experience in all areas of complex litigation. Jonathan is internationally recognized for his work in this area. He's spoken all around the world on these issues. Briefly, since there's a lot of background here on things that Jonathan's done, but most really notably, he helped found and was the first chair of and is currently chair emeritus of the highly successful Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production. He's also co-chair of the acclaimed Georgetown University Law School CLE Advanced eDiscovery Institute, which is having a couple CLEs next week, or I plan to be. Jonathan has been recognized for the second consecutive year for exceptional standing in the legal community in Chambers USA, America's leading lawyers for business, for 2009 for privacy and data security and eDiscovery. He was a founder of virtual e-discovery law firm before joining Nixon Peabody of Redgrave, Daly, Reagan, and Wagner. I was also a partner of Jones Day before that. Both of you, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure. When you say all those nice things about me, I wish you'd send a copy to my wife.
Okay. let's jump in. I read bios, but I always like to hear Judge Rosenbaum, how did you decide to or get interested in electronic discovery?
I actually stumbled into it about 26,000 years ago when I became a judge. Very shortly after I started, I got a case called Meade versus West. Meade versus West had to do with computers and what became Lexis. Meade has turned into Lexis. They sued West over the copyright over a claim of a copyright on their pages. That got me involved in computers. That got me involved in computers and law. And from there, it's been a downhill slope.
Jonathan, we've had you on before. I think we agreed you live in this space. So why don't we just jump into the subject matter, okay? Let's talk about proportionality knee discovery. And first, Jonathan, what's the basis of this word being looked to by so many people in the field as one of the keys of how to manage the depth of which a knee discovery matter can soak up resources for a party in a lawsuit?
Well, the genesis in the rules goes all the way back to 1983 when the Rules Committee put in what was known as the proportionality rules, which gave the great authority to district court judges to balance the requests for discovery against the needs of the case and the burdens imposed upon the parties. Today, it's seen in Rule 26B2C. One could make a very credible argument, though, that proportionality, of course, goes back to Rule 1 itself, the first rule in the Rules of Civil Procedure, talking about the just, speedy, and inexpensive resolution of matters. But altogether, the rules have a strong empowerment of courts to look at what a matter is about and to make sure that the means that are employed to get to the end of the suit, whether it's a trial before a judge, a trial before a jury, whether it's going to be adjudicated on some mechanism short of that, whether it be summary judgment or even earlier, that all the things that go into the discovery rules between Rule 26 and Rule 37, that these things are going to make sense. It's almost a common sense concept built into the rules. Now, of course, if you look at the case law and even a lot of the secondary commentaries talking about the cases and the rules, proportionality has never really been something that everyone had off the tip of their tongue, and people were really slugging at each other through the 1980s and the 1990s. Only really recently people have kind of come back to proportionality, and I say recently, in the last 10 years, and understood, you know, we've really got to get a good handle on this. And this electronic discovery world has helped push that, mainly because of the volumes and the potential expense of having to go through terabytes of data has just really overwhelmed a lot of parties. So they've looked for what arguments can they make, and they found proportionality. And it's not just an argument that can be made by someone who's trying to avoid discovery. It can be a very good argument by someone who's seeking discovery to say, I want discovery on these points and these points alone. I don't want to be buried. I want to focus on this. And the reason why we need to focus and why I need to get what I want and not just everything in the world, don't bury me, is because it should be proportional as well. So it's not a one-way street of people that are trying to limit discovery. It's just a very important concept. The one other thing I'll say, Carl, and this should kind of cover our entire discussion of this, is we need to think about proportionality in the rule as not just something that deals with the breadth, like from left to right as far as how much discovery. There should be a connection here between the timing of discovery, and we can talk about it as tiered discovery or staged discovery, but there's this second dimension of proportionality that goes along with where you are in the case. We just can't think of proportionality being that a case is worth such, so therefore, you know, X percentage of the case can be spent on discovery, and that's what proportionality is. It's a much more complex animal in terms of the value of the case, plus where you are in the case, plus the parties that are involved in the case, plus what sort of claims are involved in the case. Does it have impact outside these particular parties? So a lot of considerations have to really go into what proportionality is. But back to your first question, Rule 26B2C is the genesis in terms of the rules, and also look at Rule 1.
Okay. Judge Rosenbaum, it would seem to me that if you don't want to do something in electronic discovery, that you would immediately say this step is disproportionate to litigation. It's going to cost too much. How do you react when you see this argument made, and what do you look to before you agree or disagree?
Well, let's back up a little bit. Proportionality goes to really what we're doing here. One of the glories of electronic information retention is that it holds everything, and that is also the curse. The reality is that discovery is a process. It's a process designed to gather and marshal information that may be needed, and the fact is right now with electronic discovery and the multiplication of electronic information, it's not just needles in haystacks. There are millions of haystacks with no promises at all that there's a needle in there at all. And the costs that can be run up are just devastating, as you are well aware. And when you get a lawsuit that's, you can come in federal court for $75,000 unless there's original jurisdiction, and under those circumstances, it can even be less. But you can get $100,000, $200,000, even $1 million case, and it's nothing at all to run up $4 million in discovery. That doesn't make sense. And the short version of proportionality is you've got to make some sense out of this. The other part of it is, by the way, this system cannot continue. It doesn't take a genius to take a look and see how the economy's working, but no business wants to spend $300,000 for a $75,000 case. That's just not a way to do business. There are cases, undoubtedly, that are worth millions of dollars in discovery, but it's not everyone that comes along. But with a computer, you can get there pretty quick. Now, the complaint that he says it's disproportionate. There's two parts to that. First of all, judges have always been concerned about proportionality. Just the fact that you can take 200 depositions, there are reasons why the rules were recently modified, as only the courts think 6 years ago is recently, but why depositions were now defined as one day. It's just not sensible to have depositions that go on for weeks, and the rules were changed to handle that, and frankly, judges had handled that before the rules formalized it. What you're looking at is a set of a series of efforts to try and control things. To finally get to the objection that might be raised, judge, they're raising this and they're tying my hands. Lawyers are wonderful people. They are trained to find problems in any given set of circumstances. No lawyer ever got in trouble for not citing, for failing to cite potential problems. Lawyers' first reaction to virtually any change is, this isn't going to work, there's too many problems, and most of them never develop. Basically, I think that it is a kind of objection that can be raised, but once we sit down and square it away, it usually goes away.
So Jonathan, I mean, there's a lot of gray in this, depending on the type of matter and the timing, as you said, et cetera.
I'd like to see a little more gray matter in a few more of the cases I work on.
What efforts do you need to make as a lawyer to really make proportionality work for you? It's more than a word. What's the effort behind it to understand it, to apply it?
Well, Carl, I would say it's going to be a little bit of alliteration here. We'll see if you pick up on the letter. The first thing is understanding the case. You need to understand what your causes of action are, what you're actually trying to prove, what your defenses are, and because everything comes back to relevance. The key gateway under Rule 26 to discovery is relevance. And if you don't understand the case, you can't possibly make any arguments with respect to proportionality, as it goes back to what's relevant in the matter and adjudicating it consistent with Rule 1. Second is understanding the context, okay? You're making an argument for proportionality. What is the context, both in terms of the case? I mean, is this just a single one plaintiff case, or is it a putative class action? Does it deal with constitutional rights? All those things can impact proportionality. At the same time, context is also, well, how many servers are there? Is it old legacy data? Is it just all on one laptop? You know, what's the context for the facts that are going to be underlying your arguments and proportionality? The third is understanding the clock. And that's going back to my timing point earlier. Where are you in the lawsuit? Does it make sense to go full bore? Or should we have limited discovery, and why? And why is that consistent with proportionality in Rule 1 to adjudicate the matter? You also need to understand cooperation. The key about being able to sit down with the other side and at times with the court to explain what you're doing and why it makes sense now, why it doesn't make sense to go further, and why that's consistent with what the case is about and the context. And finally, I go back to common sense. The people that I think are most successful in discovery disputes and at least negotiating discovery compromises or protocols are those that exercise common sense and reasonableness, and quite frankly, at the end of the day, they're the most reasonable person standing before Judge Rosenbaum or someone else. They can make articulate arguments about what the case is about and how the discovery plan that they've set forth makes sense with what the case is.
Well, I'm glad I counted five C's. You were scaring me with my fourth C wine tied in the Zuba Lake. I was going to have to recreate it. So anyway, that's very helpful. Judge Rosenbaum, working it out makes a lot of sense when you're looking at mutually assured destruction. You know, maybe your example with your Mead versus West case, where you've got two parties both with ESI. But you know, what happens when only one side has a lot of ESI? And the reason I ask this, I did a few shows with a solo practitioner who does a lot of plaintiff work, and he made it clear he wants all the ESI because he doesn't want the other side making the calls on what isn't worth going after. He fears he's going to lose a lot of evidence of culpability when the defendants have too much leeway. So how do you react in situations when the sides just can't agree on what's a fair outcome?
Well, let's start out at the beginning for a moment. One of the advantages of being old, and there are not very many advantages of being old, I should point out, is that you've seen a lot of things that have happened before. Your sole practitioner years ago used to complain to me and come to court and say, Judge, I asked for this information, and they gave me the key to a warehouse, and there's so much information in it, I'll never be able to get through it. They're a rich party, and they're killing me. So then you heard from the plaintiff's lawyer, who the poor soul was having a hard time. Now you hear from the defense firm. The defense firm says, oh my God, there's so many computers, this is going to take us so much time, we'll never get through it. And now I'm hearing the weeping and seeing the crocodile tears on the other side of the table. I do this for a living. So the answer to some of it is, nobody ought to be allowed to use, I mean, let's get around to what discovery is about. Jonathan said, and he's correct, that it has to do with relevance. But what it really has to do with, as he knows very well, is it has to do with claims and defenses. That's the scope. And the fact that you can use part of the court's devices, and that's what the rules are, to injure and afflict the other side is not what those rules were set up to do. And a judge will not be party to it, and a lawyer's not going to get away with it. So the fact that a lawyer, and you see it not infrequently right now because I want every document in the world, you don't need every document in the world. You need the documents related to your claims and defenses. And when that comes down, you can tend to handle these things pretty easily. The fact that one side or another screams, life is tough for me, I get used to that. It is what happens in my work.
Jonathan, do we already have a pretty good sense of what is too much to do? I mean, if you look at litigation dockets for large law firms, they seem to be lower than in 2008. Are clients making a quasi-proportionality response to the perceived higher cost of e-discovery? And if so, are they making the right call at this point, or do we have to do more to show value?
Well, a couple of things, Carl. I'm not sure that the docket load at large law firms is indicative of where any company is going or any defendant or plaintiff, for that matter, is going in terms of proportionality of discovery. I think it just reflects a lot of people are holding their breath to see what the economy does. Although in terms of the core question you're asking, you know, do we have a sense of how much is too much for discovery? Yes and no. I mean, clearly, folks that pay attention to this heard exactly what the judge just said, and that is, you know, you're supposed to focus on the claims and defenses. That's your core aspect of what's relevant in the matter. And you know, getting there doesn't mean you get to run roughshod and have 100,000 interrogatories. You don't get to take 100 depositions and have each one last 45 days. Slowly over the course of time, because there were excesses, we consistently cut back. But the concept that's everywhere else except in Rule 34 is the fact that there are real limits here, and you got to pick and choose. And you, as a lawyer, have got to exercise the J word, which is judgment. And the problem we have is that so many people aren't willing to exercise judgment and say, you know what, we only really need to focus on this pocket of information because that really goes with the claim. We only really need to get this information to provide us what we need on the defense. It's usually people that are afraid of making judgments that say they need the entire world. So in terms of, you know, do people have a good sense of how much is too much? Well, you can look at a case that's worth $1 million, and if you got credible evidence before a court that's going to cost $4 million to process the data, you know, most people say, you know, there really is a problem there. But short of, you know, having something that's that clear cut, I think there's still a lot of people fishing trying to understand how to really get their way through to understand what is too much. I asked this question at the ABA conference this year. I asked the entire panel and I asked the audience, well, what would you say? If the claim's worth $1 million, you can spend $100,000. Is that too much? Is $500,000, 50% of the perceived matter value, if you could actually agree on it, is that too much? No one really has a mathematical answer to this, and it comes back to, I hate to say this, but the judge pegged it again. And he didn't say this word, but the gut sense about what's really going on. Set aside the crocodile tears, set aside the whining. What's the case about? What are the claims and defenses, and what do you need to get there? And, you know, if people get to that level of understanding of their case, then they are able to make proportionality arguments very well about, judge, they're asking us to do this, it's going to cost $200,000, and they don't just say cost $200,000, it doesn't get us any further to understanding the validity of that defense, or it doesn't really forward, Your Honor, your ability to adjudicate on summary judgment that claim. And that's when it zeroes in on proportionality, because it's not just the cost, it's what good does this discovery do to forward the ball of resolving the matter.
Let me play a little bit on that, Lute. I appreciate it. I think it's very important to understand. I was a trial lawyer. I tried a lot of cases. And I've tried many, many, many since I've been on the bench, as you might guess, in the 700 years of my career. There's no such thing as a five million document case. There's about 20 documents that make a darn bit of difference in almost any case. And the ones that really matter usually are two or three sentences or two or three paragraphs. Now, you may have to sieve a great deal of water to pull out the things that are the ones that are the diamonds. But at a certain point, it is just recognized that even though you might get the one piece of truth you need in the 100th deposition, we're not going to let you take 100 depositions. And in case this message has not gotten clear, I hate to bring up two of the most terrifying words in the English language. I'm not actually sure that either one is English, but I think they probably will resonate with you. One of them is called Twombly. And the other one is called Iqbal. And those two terrifying words carry another message with them. Twombly is explicit that the costs of discovery, at least according to the Supreme Court, are matters of extreme concern. And Iqbal says that you have got to be able to make a statement when you start about what the case is about. The key, and I think that what's important in both of them, is a principle that goes back all the way back to the founding of the rules. Discovery is not so that you can make your case. Discovery is so you can flesh out a case which you know exists and have facts that show that there really was something that happened. And so we're not going to permit under either proportionality, under the rules, or under Twombly and Iqbal, we're not going to permit you to make a claim and then conduct endless discovery to see if you have a case. It's to flesh out and prove your case. That's where we're going. So I think that one of the places that you can start is having a clear idea of where you really want to be when you begin your case. I know that there will be things to look for, but if they're relevant ones and they do prove your claim or defenses, you'll get your discovery. The next is a lawyer really ought to understand the systems that they're dealing with so that they are not just running around just because something exists in a computer's memory. You need to know what you're looking for, and there will be a certain effort to keep you focused on targeting what you're aimed at.
Judge Rosenbaum, you know, you talked about, or Jonathan talked about judgment, and you talked about, having experience. A lot of analysts, when they look at this field, point out there's a shortage of skilled people in electronic discovery. Does that impact proportionality at all? Because getting to the understanding of what you're dealing with, and then you throw in the fact there's so many different systems between companies and industries and technologies always evolving, is this sometimes a trickier calculation because of this?
Absolutely. And I will tell you, if I have got a case And I have Jonathan on one side and a couple other lawyers of his competence. By the way, there are not many in that category. I'm going to have a cupcake of a time in my lawsuit. My problem is when I have lawyers who are not familiar, lawyers who do not understand the nature of their claims in many cases, then you're going to have a much, much more difficult time. Jonathan, I believe, would start a case with an idea of where he'd like it to end. There are lawyers who sometimes are not real clear about those kinds of things. But the reality is there are, as I understand it, fortunately thus far I have not had to deal with it, there are brain surgeons who are really good at what they do and brain surgeons who are not as good. That's how it works. In either case, however, one is real good for the patient and one is not so good for the patient. The key is being lucky or smart enough to find out which one you want to have. But by and large, of course, differing skills in lawyers are like differing skills in brain surgeons or chefs or anything else that you think is important.
And you don't tend to see a lot of motions, I bet, that I'm not very competent in this area, right?
Let me put it this way. It becomes quite obvious when I see the motion. I don't need the lawyer to make the statement. I, of course, have never seen such practitioners in Minnesota, by the way, but I've heard that there are less competent ones in other areas.
Well, let's go into a couple of areas where proportionality might come up and do come up frequently and see if we get any general agreement.
The answer is probably not.
Okay, well, first of all, Jonathan, you can start at it, and then you can disagree if you want, Judge Rosenbaum. Backup tapes. Did the arguments work well in this area?
Well, as a general matter, they can work well in this area if supported by the facts. And the reason why I hedge it around like that, if you have someone that's not well versed or hasn't done their homework, just come in and say backup tapes, wow, we don't need to go there, it's disproportionate, that doesn't get you anywhere. It's kind of like walking in and saying, gee, there's a box in the back of the room, Judge, we shouldn't do that, I've got to cut the tape to get in there. You've got to have facts for whatever burden argument you're going to make, and in any of these proportionality arguments, there's an element of proving up that you have burdens, and if you can do it articulately and with facts, then you're off to, you know, a reasoned discussion with the other side and with a judge helping you to figure out what's going to make sense in a given case. Backup tapes can be, you know, with those factual predicates out there, can definitely be an area where you can have the argument succeed, saying that this is not proportional to go there because it's going to be expensive. But again, technology continuously changes, and depending on the tapes, it may or may not be disproportionately expensive to go to some of them or to take samples of some of them. So it, just like any of these categories we might run through here, there isn't just a magic button that says, yep, it's out of the, it's always going to be disproportionate or you've got a great argument. It depends on the facts.
And I think, you know, you have to deal with what we're dealing with. Most cases do not deal with histories going back 10 years or 12 years or something like that. You have an employment case, almost no matter how big it is, you're going to be dealing with things of relative currency. Lots of backup tapes are historical, and one of the biggest problems with backup tapes is, since nobody uses tapes anymore hardly at all anyway, they just sit back and rot and get old. You know, if you're looking for data on an original weighing, or you're looking for punch paper from an old IBM system or punch cards, you better have an awfully good reason why you want to get back into that kind of material. If you're talking about legacy systems or archival stuff, frankly, I'm one who believes that backup tapes will become less important over the next few years. We now have, and everybody's got, computers that have 100 gig memories and supplemented by another 250 gig backups. At that point, everything is basically on your desktop, unless you really have some strange reason. And there are cases that do, but not many, where you have to go back to things that took place 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, or longer in the history. But barring those kinds of things, I think backup tapes will be a less relevant examination.
Well, the next, I'm going to guess that the answer is going to be pretty much the same for a lot of these categories. So why don't we sort of change the question to, are you seeing more of this type of an argument? How about database systems where it's hard to get data out of them? They just weren't designed to produce data. you can amend your answer as well that you already gave for each of these areas. But what do you think?
Well, Carl, for database systems, that's going to be really dependent on what database you're talking about. Truly, corporate database construction wasn't necessarily meant with discovery in a civil litigation in mind. However, most databases were created to manage, store, and then produce information in various report formats. So it may not do it the way that a plaintiff or a requesting party might want in a case, but more often than not, you're able to sit down, explain the capabilities if it's a relevant system that goes to claims and defenses, and then you figure out what you can produce out of it. And that's the way you deal with the potential burden, and you don't let other people just kind of come in and sit down at the terminal of the opposing party's computer system. But just because it may not have been built for discovery, and just because it might be an extraordinarily large database that you can't copy and give to the other side, you wouldn't do that anyway, it doesn't mean there's not going to be a proportional solution. It's not an all or nothing switch.
I think very significant to that and tied in with it, very few businesses were originally organized in hopes of someday being able to produce information in lawsuits. That is not usually a corporate goal. Businesses are usually in business to do business, and they set up systems that are useful and helpful to them. Now, obviously, modern litigation is a factor in business, and people have come to understand that, and they do certain things in conformance with that. But the reality is that setting up and worrying about what your next lawsuit's going to be is not a major goal of most businesses. So their information will not frequently have been organized with those kinds of ideas in mind.
You know, we were talking a little bit before the call about, before you got on, Jonathan, about the third-party subpoenas being an issue where proportionality can enter in, especially when we enter the cloud and providers might control data and have some cost for them to retrieve this data. It might be challenging, especially if it's not their dispute. So what's your reaction to proportionality for third-party people?
Well, Carl, this is an area where the rule provides additional protections about undue cost not being borne by a non-party to the litigation that might have responsive information or relevant information. And so the rule gives a lot of power to that non-party to kind of say, hey, wait a second here. This is an extraordinarily burdensome subpoena. It's broad. It has these certain elements here. If you want us to do this, you should bear the costs, or you know, get into cost shifting or cost sharing, other means by which the burden on that non-party can be ameliorated. So I believe that the Rule 45, really gives those non-parties and their attorneys, if they're awake, a great set of arguments to go before a judge to say, not only do we need proportionality, but this is different. We're not a party in interest in this lawsuit. We've got greater rights to be protected against intrusion and burden.
I really agree. You know, their argument, and it does not usually fall on deaf ears, is I ain't got a dime in this game. Why in the world am I being hit with this cost? I mean, obviously, every citizen is obligated to give their evidence and provide it to under normal circumstances. But normal becomes stretched when the cost starts to approximate several hundred thousand bucks. And at a certain point, a court is going to say, if you want this information from this kind of a source, these people are entitled to some help. And a court is not going to be unsympathetic.
You know, one of the battles we all face is trying to help the uneducated understand this area better. And since proportionality is such a big key to this area, I was just curious, Jonathan, from your perspective, how do we get a better sense of what's possible and what really costs too much? Is it national think tanks like the group you deeply involved in, Sedona or EDRM, publishing standards, or is it case by case with lawyers crafting their individual arguments? Where do you think we're going to come to some agreement?
Well, obviously, a group like Sedona do a good job of pushing out publications and doing educational programs. Ken Withers, who's a judicial education director there, is terrific. You know, the Georgetown conference that you mentioned coming up, lots of great folks there to kind of delve into these issues as well. The reality is, I think, would really benefit us, and I'll give you a tip of the hat to the Minnesota Bar, which I'm a member of, even though I live out in the Washington, D.C. area, is the federal bar association, the local chapter there, has this monthly luncheon with the federal judges, and topics come up. Yeah, and the ability for the practitioners to really work with each other and talk with the judges about the real world issues facing litigants of all types in the courts, in terms of what does it proportionality mean. So I would just encourage more local dialogue among the bench and the bar as to, okay, you know, not to, in a specific case, you can't talk outside the context of the courtroom for a specific case, but in terms of hypotheticals, in terms of just grappling with these issues, so there's a greater level of common understanding among the bar appearing before that court about what the judges expect to be made with respect to proportionality arguments, what things fly, what things don't fly, to just give a greater sense to the community standard of, you know, these are real arguments. You need to be able to understand it no matter what side you are on the discovery dispute. You need to understand, you know, really what Sedona and other places are talking about in terms of cooperation. What does it mean to come into a courtroom and cooperatively talk about, and even if you have a dispute, placing the argument before the court about why is this discovery disproportionate or why is it actually proportionate, and laying it out there so you can have a sound, reasoned decision on a good factual record. Those are the kinds of things I think that need to happen across the country, having more dialogue in that local level so all the players involved, from the judges to the lawyers, can understand that. And then the critical thing here for the lawyers, they can then turn around and explain to the clients, many of whom might be from outside of that jurisdiction, how this is going to work in this courtroom, what we need to do to present our arguments with respect to burden, or if I'm seeking the discovery, with respect to need and why it ties again to the claims and defenses. We just cannot lose sight of the gateway to all of this, the claims and defenses and relevance.
So let me, you know, the word proportionality, particularly as it's now come up in the last couple of months, or really couple of years, in a very real sense, it's a word that we've used for a long, long time. It's reasonable. And lawyers, I remember when you were first in law school and you had to start to learn what, I'm so old, it used to be the reasonable man, but now it's a reasonable person. And at the beginning when you first, well, come on, what's reasonable? What's reasonable? And this is a big debate, you know, and it's a hard thing to teach to young law students. But lawyers work with reasonable all the time. And proportional in this area, particularly, is balancing the cost against the value, is a reasonability test. I think that one of the things, if I can focus from the standpoint of a judge who sees some of this, and you kind of touched on it, Jonathan, it's very nice. You throw a rose to the Minnesota bar, but I think the reality is, the biggest sets of problems develop between lawyers who don't know each other very well. Lawyers who work with each other tend to be more reasonable in their relationships with each other. And to the extent that they are far apart, do not know each other, and realize or have the view that they may never have to cross meet this person again in any other context, that's when you tend to get more of the flame throwing. If somebody knows that next year we're going to have another case with each other, or next year I may be at that firm for something else, you get a lot less of the foolishness. And focusing a little more on the relationships, the Sedona Conference didn't start out with these working groups, and Jonathan has made a tremendous contribution working with them and coming up with the Sedona principles, but that wasn't the goal. There were lots of lawyers, plaintiff's lawyers, defense lawyers, corporate lawyers, lawyers who worked for businesses, general counsel, people who were dealing in all these things, and in some of the buy discussions, as they got to know each other better, this was before the rules were modified, they sat down and said, you know, how are we getting through these? What are best ways to keep ourselves out of these messes? And that's really how these rules, how the principles came into existence. It's those same analyses that a judge is going to want to see and that the lawyers ought to do, which will make proportionality come to real fruition.
You know, I want to throw in just a couple of economic questions in this. You know, does the word proportionality have flexibility given the state of the economy? There was a recent survey of in-house counsel by Altman Weil. They said in-house legal departments are cutting spending by 11% in 2009. And, you know, is the fact that the clients are, you know, all corporate, you know, departments in most companies are watching everything they spend, so they can do less. Does that impact, you know, what the word proportionality means?
The short answer is, of course. You know, the other dirty little secret, which I will never reveal in public except to this particular podcast, is lawyers have some incentive to do discovery. They make a lot of money doing it. Cases settle. And that is, if somebody told you you can prepare a case and it's going to cost you $40 to get ready for trial, there'd be an awful lot of orthodontists, colleges, automobile manufacturers who would go out of business in a heartbeat. That isn't the way things work. The reality is that there are financial incentives all the way around. But what we're hearing from are the payors, and the payors are screaming bloody murder. This is costing a lot of money, and in many cases, it is not obvious that they're obtaining much value for it.
The other economic question I wanted to ask, we talked a little bit about it before we started the show, is you have some defendants and some litigants who are serial litigants. You know, they got to get good at this stuff. This is they're going to be in court all the time. But then you have some companies that, you know, they might have five cases a year, and then a big one comes along. Is the investment you got to make to be ready for e-discovery, is there a proportionality aspect to that?
And well, Carl, I'll take a swing at that. I really think that there is. I mean, there's a recognition on the part of the judiciary, and Judge Rosenbaum can check me on this one, is that people who are serial litigants, there's a bit of greater expectation that they've got their act together. They understand everything from the preservation, collection to production. They're going to be able to address the issues the other side might have or the judge might have and do it competently and quickly, whereas a little bit more grace will be thrown to the party that, you know, doesn't have a large IT staff, hasn't been involved in a lot of litigation, and is looking at, you know, complex technologies and a lot of requests and trying their best. In both cases, I think what people look to is that you're being reasonable, acting in good faith. But I think those parties that show up more, more is expected of them. Judge?
I think, you know, just pulling names out of a hat, major Dow Chemical, Ford Motor Company, any airline, aircraft parts manufacturers, these are what I refer to as professional defendants. They have, you know, a company like Dow Chemical has probably had some form of a document hold on some of their documents probably since the mid-20s, maybe earlier than that. And believe me, that ain't the 2020s. These people are very good. They know how to handle their equipment. When somebody says, here comes a litigation hold, nobody runs in circles and screams and goes crazy. They've got procedures set up for it. You alluded to companies that have five cases a year. I see lots and lots and lots of litigants who have one case in their lifetime. A small business, a small manufacturer, a company that begins to do something and are all of a sudden charged with patent infringement on something that they were really likely not expecting. And the reality is they have done nothing to prepare for these kinds of things. And all of a sudden, it's like a lone skier on a huge mountain, and all of a sudden they see an avalanche coming. And of course, you have to make some sense out of that, and you have to say that we're going to hold these to different kind of standards.
Well, those are great points.
Prepared to withdraw them.
I didn't hear Jonathan disagree either, so there's got to be, I think, a good sense of agreement on this one, too. So that's pretty much, you know, all I had in terms of asking questions in this area. I don't know if you have any final conclusions you want to say about where you think proportionality is going to sort of wrap this up.
All I can tell you is I think several years ago I wrote another article that didn't begin with the title of In Defense Of. It was called The Death of E-Discovery. And the essence of it is that every dispute that I have seen in the e-discovery world, in one form or another, existed in the paper world. Human beings sometimes mess things up. Human beings sometimes are perfidious. Human beings sometimes intentionally lie. But all of those things, none of those have changed. The fact that we now store the information electronically didn't change what they do. I guess the one thing that probably didn't exist is the risk of an electromagnetic shock that can wipe out everything. But those kinds of things, I guess, may not have existed in the paper world unless you call them fires. But setting all of that aside, courts have dealt with these kinds of problems for a very long time. And human beings are going to continue to have problems from time to time, which will lead to lawsuits. That, however, keeps me employed. With those thoughts in mind, I think that just plain being rational, trying to make sense, and if you can't explain a good reason why you want something, you probably are going to have a harder time getting it in a proportionality system.
Well, that sounds like a good way to end the show. I want to thank both of you for joining our show today. It's a very interesting topic and critical to how eDiscovery is handled as we move forward. To our listeners, thank you for listening to our show. For a complete list of ESI Bytes shows, visit www.esibytes.com. And remember what we all say here, you should visit ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. Thanks again. This is Carl Schoeneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review with Jurnov. Have a nice day.